Caution, caution. Manual, fuel, manual, fuel.
I'm John Golia.
I'm Greg Fife.
And I'm Todd Curtis.
And we are the Flight Safety Detectives.
Between us, we have over a century of aviation accident investigation and safety experience to draw on as we discuss issues that affect all of us.
So we are qualified to share our perspectives on accidents and incidents and what can be learned from them for the future.
We're proud to say that we have two sponsors that really relate to the topic of aviation safety: the Professional Aviation Maintenance Association, or PAMA, and Avemco Insurance. Later on in the show, we'll tell you how you can get a 5% discount on your insurance just for listening to the show.
We don't just dissect the official reports. In every episode, we identify safety issues and take the mystery out of accident investigations.
So maybe pilots and their planes can have safer flights ahead.
Welcome to this Flight Safety Detectives live screen. We're pleased to have you here today with myself and John Golia. Greg Fife will be joining us shortly, and we're here to speak to you directly, take your questions and answer them fully and one would hope competently. And I'd like to thank all you premier subscribers who are able to see the live stream. And again, we hope that what we're bringing you is going to be worth your while. And one of the things we wanted to do was talk about some of the issues of the day. And recently, the most important thing, at least for us in aviation safety, has been the recent release of the preliminary report from the NTSB about the UPS crash in Louisville. And we'd like to start off our show with a question about that. And we had a listener, Crystal, let me get this the name right, Chris Trobel, 3439. I'm surprised you guys have been completely quiet regarding the recent MD-11 DC-10 news. But okay, that's cool. Carry on. Well, I was going to answer the question one way before we did what we did last week. We had a special show coming out this weekend, episode 303, where we addressed directly the UPS crash, and we talked about the preliminary report. So why didn't we do something right off the bat, as many people online have done, and some of these people we like, some we talked about on the show, but our basic philosophy is we're going to say something when there's something worth saying. We're going to say something when we have something to say. And most importantly, we're going to say something about an event when there's facts and data on the ground that we can talk about. And that was the case with the NTSB releasing the preliminary report. It is preliminary, so they're not going to come to a conclusion as to what happened. It is something that has facts on the ground, some of which we knew about ahead of time, some of which were new. And it was very insightful because it just put to the test some of the theories that are out there. And let's just say that a lot of the theories as to what happened, which came out early, were not necessarily incorrect, but they were based on the lack of information. Going forward, there will be more information. There will be a final report. It'll come out roughly a year from now. It'll be much more detailed than what was in the preliminary report. But I highly recommend you go to the episode 303 webpage that supports that episode, rather. We will have downloadable copies of the preliminary report and other information that's related to this accident.
But really, you know, I watched all those shows, and the misinformation based upon not factual information was frankly, it was sickening, because they were talking about things that they had no right talking about. You know, and one of the things that always gets under my skin is when pilots start to opinionate, opine on maintenance issues. What pilots see with maintenance barely scratches the surface. They never see what's going on in the hangar. They never see all the work that's done that's virtually invisible and to the outside world. And then they're making comments on channels like this after an incident that lead the families, the crew members, the other employees that watch every word that people say about, you know, their accident, so to speak. It's just a disservice to everybody to be just putting a bunch of words out there that are not based on fact. And we try desperately not to do that.
And so, we can certainly add more about this event. We're not going to add it now because, again, things are still evolving. And, again, tip of the hat to the NTSB. And I think, John, you tipped your hat to them in our episode 303, talking about how quickly they brought to bear this report. The event happened on, I believe, the 4th of November. And the preliminary report came out, I believe, it was the 20th of November.
It was extremely quick. You know, it really was on a very, very detailed report for 2 weeks into it. Hats off to my former colleagues at the NTSB because they really did a good job of shutting down a lot of the speculation. You know, I only once did I have to do that in my career at the NTSB, and that was involved in a event in Charlotte with a Midwest Express that was flying for U.S. Air. And the so-called experts, when I got down there at 10 o'clock in the morning of the first day, it was all over the place. And I just let the companies keep talking. Normally, we muzzle them. If you want to be part of the investigation, you don't go on TV and talk. But I let them talk for a while to defend themselves against the so-called experts then. But then I asked the companies not to do that any longer. And then I disclosed information on our, what we call the stand-up at noontime and one in the evening. But the one in the afternoon, I disclosed raw data to the press just to cut off the speculation from the so-called experts that were actually causing a problem with the investigation. You know, they were talking about security issues. They were talking about what's on the airplane. The FBI was involved. So it was just out of control. So, you know, I shut everybody up, essentially, and then I just disclosed the information. But this example, this current one from the NTSB on the UPS accident, even went further than what I did in that example. And it really is a tribute to them to do that because it really stopped the speculation. You've noticed that since the report came out, that and many of these captains and other people that have all these opinions, how quiet they've become because the information is so much better and so much detailed.
And, you know, we could talk further about this, but I highly recommend you go check out our episode 303. Because we went into some detail about, let's just say it, our feelings and opinions about speculation and the role that plays and the kind of media things that happen now and how they compare to the past. But we'd like to go forward by going a little bit backwards. We're going to go back to episode 301, which part of that, we had a discussion about why we at the Flight Safety Detectives were referring to the Gulf of Mexico rather than the Gulf of America for very particular reasons. Now, there was a listener who, after hearing our reason, his comment was rather short. Screw Trump. Now, I look at comments from people who write to us by asking myself, what's the question I see inside of this comment? Given the conversation we had during that show, I think the question he was really trying to ask, or at least my opinion of the question he was trying to ask, is why do politicians do political things that get in the way of aviation safety? And I will respond exactly with what I wrote on the website. So if you go to episode 301, you'll see these exact words which I wrote in response to what the HAR 2000 said. One of the things that fascinates me about aviation is the way that over time, policy endures longer than politics, and no one politician, no matter their amount of real or imagined power, can radically change the evolution of the global aviation industry. Over a half century ago, I found it shocking that the U.S. under the legendary anti-communist Richard Nixon was willing to allow Boeing to sell 707s to the People's Republic of China. Fast forward to today, and the PRC is Boeing's biggest market. Are the U.S. and the PRC at odds over multiple political issues? Are both countries pointing nits at each other? When it comes to aviation, can we all just get along? All these things can be true at the same time. Now, for all of you out there who are listening, most of you don't remember seeing Richard Nixon on television or seeing Richard Nixon, doing his famous V for Victory sign. But John, you were very much in the industry during the early 70s. And I mean, I was only about 13 years old when that happened. And I was tuned in enough to the world politics to realize that this is like incredible. We're actually doing something at a high level with the People's Republic of China. I mean, what's your feeling about not just what our commentator said, but I'd like to hear your views on that too, but how aviation has globalized over the last few decades?
Well, aviation has shrunk the world. All right, so we all pulled together. And I was in the industry when Nixon made all those moves. And those of us in the industry actually thought that was a great idea because it opened up all kinds of markets for the U.S. products, and mainly we were interested in aviation products that China was buying all they could have. And many of us commented at the time, and I was only a pretty young guy, but I recognized that they're going to buy our products today, but they're going to be a competitor to us tomorrow. And that's exactly what happened. But you know what? When you're buying goods and services across political lines like that, you know, it's tough to start a war. It's tough to fight with the people that are supplying you with steel or supplying you with whatever it is they're supplying you with. You got to really balance all of that off, and it tempers some of the wild swings that we get from politicians that have a different agenda sometimes. So, and I think everybody can see that today with what's going on in our country, that we got political swings all over the place. Are they going to be productive? I don't know. I have my doubts, but I've seen some positive things come out of all the tariff craziness that's been going on. And there's been some negative things as well. But we'll have to wait and see what really develops, and hope that our politicians have enough sense to keep it pretty average, pretty calm and collected.
And one comment I'd like to say about the globalization of aviation is the globalization of aviation safety. When I first got into the industry in the early 90s, one of the big concerns was you had a situation where cockpit crews were behaving differently in different countries. We had assumptions that, oh, they'll act just like we do here in the States or here in Western Europe. And we saw that that was not the case. And the industry took an inward look at ourselves and said, it's not them, it's all of us. That is, rethinking how relationships exist within the cockpit and in the maintenance shop and on the flight line. What's the role of leadership in the cockpit? Is the captain always right? Is the captain able to shout down the first officer or the second officer or the navigator when the captain thinks he or she is right? That might have been the case beforehand, but one of the fundamental changes that happened is the concept of crew resource management. That is, taking stock of what you have inside the cockpit or inside the workspace and allowing everyone, no matter what their level of power or influence or time on the job, can speak up and say something, in many cases save lives. And that's an ongoing issue. It's an ongoing struggle. And in my opinion, it was not a question of how can we make everybody think like us? It was more a question of how do we rethink how we behave? And how can we put structures in place so the very nature of how an aircraft is operated or how an aircraft is maintained is such that at each step, there's a check and balance. At each step, there's an opportunity to say something positive to keep something bad from happening. Now, that's my stump speech. And John, you've seen this from a whole different perspective.
Well, I've seen the bad side of it all. And I've seen the bad side of some of our operators around the world that haven't taken heed to some of the suggestions that were made. But doesn't mean we stop. We have to keep trying to help those areas improve. you know, we just see that, that there's some, maybe some problems in Asia, and we need to make sure that we're helping with information and anywhere else we can, those airlines and those people to get better. And, you know, we in the U.S. have been blessed with very few accidents in the last over 15 years. And actually 20, that's, you know, we can count them on just on our fingers on one hand. So we've been blessed with that. So we need to duplicate what we've been doing, share what we've been doing to all the other airlines around the world, and drive down their accident rate. Because the accident rate in some countries, in some areas of this world, is way too high. You know, and oftentimes I'll tell, when talking about the continent of Africa and the crashes that occur there, right? The people that are flying on commercial airplanes in developing countries like those in Africa are the people that are trying to drive their economies and their countries forward. And when we lose them on an accident in an airplane, that impacts those countries and the development of those countries and moving up, you know, the poverty and the food supply and all the rest of the things that impoverished countries need to do. And they're losing the talent that would be helping them to elevate their countries because of an airplane accident. We need to put good effort, solid effort into helping those countries not have those accidents. You know, and accidents are supposed to be a random event. But sometimes we've been able to say they're going to have an accident in that country because they're not operating the way they should be operating. We see it coming. And that's an area that I don't want to be a prophet in. I don't want to be able to say that they're going to have an incident or an accident. I want to say that we're all working together to drive safety to the highest level we can. And some of our efforts need to be redoubled in that area, especially in developing countries.
And that brings up the next question on the next show we're going to talk about, episode 302, where we discuss at great length basic med, which was a kind of medical certification that allows pilots to fly using a level of scrutiny that's not as high as for the typical medical certificate. I have a class 3 medical myself for flying small aircraft, not for doing commercial flights, but just to be a basic pilot learning how to fly. But there is a level below that called basic med. And we talked about two events that happened this year that involved pilots who are flying under basic med who are also rather advanced age. But before we go into the details of that, I'd like to thank Doug Vries, 372, or Doug DeVries, 372, for calling us out on making a mistake. By us, I mean me. He said, not a question, but someone pointing out a mistake. At 8 minutes and 31 seconds of the show, you stated that under basic med, you can't fly instrument rated. That is not correct. IFR flight is permitted under basic med. You, sir or ma'am, is absolutely correct. I was wrong, dead wrong, and I'm here to say that when I was reading through basic med for the show, I looked at the restrictions of basic med, and I didn't look carefully enough. There is a restriction that says that under basic med, you can fly up to 18,000 feet above mean sea level. And why is that important? Above 18,000 feet, if you're a pilot, you have to fly under instrument flight rules, and you have to be instrument flight rated. And although basic med does indeed allow you to fly under IFR rules, it doesn't allow you to fly in what's called Class A or Class Alpha airspace, the airspace where the airliners fly. So my hat's off to you for pointing out my error. My apologies for making the error. But the bigger point in the show, and we didn't come to a conclusion about it because there are a lot of unknowns about those two accidents. They were both in the state of having a preliminary report where they didn't go into detail such as the medical conditions of the pilots. We looked not only at those preliminary reports, but at supplemental information from other sources. We found out that the pilots were age 80 and age 87. And one of the things about basic med, you only have to be recertified every 4 years, whereas the certification I have and that Greg has, once you reach a certain age, you have to be certified every 2 years. So in a sense, you're doubling up the mean time between finding out something is wrong with you. and also the medical person who certifies you under my level of certification has to be certified by the FAA, whereas any registered physician can certify you under basic med. So that's in a big nutshell what our issue was with basic med. But we have now, Greg, you have shown.
Hey, guys, sorry. That's what happens when you're at the airport and doing a little aviating and meeting at the same time. So you like time to spare, go by air.
And you are a gentleman who does not fly under basic med. Why not?
With regard to basic med, you know, the biggest issue that's come up right now is the fact that with older pilots and going on basic med, the examination process, there are a lot of undisclosed medical conditions and drugs. The number of accidents that I've been investigating recently have involved pilots on no-fly drugs that are flying under basic med. And while basic med does require a level of self-discipline and self-reporting, we know that that's not happening as well. So the big issue, again, is if you're going to fly, you got to be fit to fly. And the FAA does expect you to be fit to fly.
Greg, over the years, you and I have both seen, while we were at the NTSB, both have seen multiple accidents every year with pilots doing we'll call it stupid things. You know, flying after, a lot of them flying after drinking, some of them flying after drinking and drugging, and that included prescription drugs, and just others just taking over the counter stuff because, you know, their nose is all clogged up, their sinuses are clogged up, and they overdose themselves with antihistamines to clean that up so they can fly without having their head feel like it's going to explode. But meanwhile, they've really upset their brain function. And I mean, I don't know what the FAA, what anybody can do to make people think properly. But we just do have a lot of people, pilots I'm talking about, that just don't do the right thing when they know better.
And one other aspect of that, John, is going to be pilot mental health that we've talked about on this show in the past. Now you've got basic myths before where they're basically self-policing. And if there is some sort of mental health issue, you know, who's going to disclose it?
You know, in part, the FAA and the industry people that have been pushing for sport aviation in the using your driver's license and basic med to fly, I mean, it's all well and good, but it requires that the people participating in that segment do the right thing. I was trying to find the right words. The right thing. And I don't think that's going to be universal. I think we're going to have a bunch of people behaving improperly.
I'll give you one more story, and then I know that Todd has other things going on as far as question and answers, but I was just recently talking to my neighbor. They were on a flight coming back from the East Coast, and about 45 minutes into the flight, they asked for anybody with medical experience on board, and the guy just happened to be sitting next to my neighbor, who was a doctor, went to the back of the airplane, was back there for quite a long time, finally came forward and sat back in his seat. My neighbor asked him if everything was okay. And they said, the guy had a seizure, passed out. They got him back and they were going to divert. And then they decided to go on to destination. Well, of course, when they got to destination, they're waiting for the paramedics. And when my neighbor said, which guy was it? Yeah, the guy that the seizure happened to, who had the medical condition, happened to be in a pilot uniform and kind of shocked my neighbor. And he said the guy was probably in his mid-40s. So now you take that case, because unfortunately that pilot's medical and definitely career could be in jeopardy depending on what was wrong with him. But now you take that under somebody with basic med who has these kinds of medical issues, who's going to disclose that? And now they get back in an airplane. So there are a lot of pluses to encouraging general aviation and giving an opportunity to those pilots who are going to be basically weekend warriors, fly, you know, for the enjoyment of flying. But it still requires a high level of operational discipline and mental discipline. And again, self-discipline as far as being responsible. So, you know, we've all had questions about it. I've always had questions about it that concern me from an accident investigation safety standpoint.
You know, I'd like to add one more piece to that, Greg. You know, I teach school, and a number of the students at a college level of school, and a number of the students are in the flight program. And I tell all of them, and they're probably sick of hearing it, that they need to make sure they graduate with some expertise in another area, airport management, right? FBO management, airline management. There's all kinds of programs out there to focus, but they need to have a fallback because none of us have a crystal ball on what's going to happen to us health-wise. And like that example of a pilot that might be in his 40s and losing his career, hopefully he's got a college education or special knowledge in some other area where he could go and continue to earn a living, because it's pretty tough to fall out of an airline job like that and then go try to find work if you don't have any other expertise.
Yeah, exactly, John.
And one last statement about, one last question rather about basic med. This is from Demerick. He had wasn't about basic med per se, but about the shutdown. But in his question or statement about the shutdown, there was something that caught my eye. And the question I saw in his long statement was, you guys are all about data. Seen any change in accident rates related to medical issues since basic med was implemented? That's a quick answer. No, because I haven't looked. But it's a reasonable question. It's a question that could possibly be addressed with the actual data that's out there, because when you have a serious accident or incident, the NTSB does make a report. And they will likely, in every case, put whether or not the pilot was on basic med or another level of certification. So, yes, it's an excellent question. It should be addressed. Now, before we look into that or anything else a little bit, I'd like to do a bit of a shout out. As all of you know, we have special membership categories from Plane Watcher to Takeoff Club to Flight Safety Insider. And we'd like to do a shout out to some of the recent additions to that list. Chuck Kay, Flight Safety Insider, very recent arrival. Thank you for that. DC, DYSI, Plane Watcher, thank you. Ducky Messier, I think that person's French. Thank you again. Michelle or Michael, 777, perhaps someone related to the 77 program. Thank you for being a Plane Watcher. Carm Matriano, I think I mispronounced this person's name in another episode. Again, you're a Flight Safety Insider. Thank you very much. Tara DePew, Flight Safety Insider. And last but not least, David McKenzie, the most recent Takeoff Club member. So thank you very much for joining. We enjoy your support. We rely on your support. And we'd like to have more of you participate at whatever level you find comfortable. This is an upcoming show about the pilot mental health questions and the pilot mental health campaign. With the help of the pilot mental health campaign was a move at the Congress to change the laws when it comes to pilot mental health. And the question from Cristobal 3429, with the help of the Pilot Mental Health Campaign, the House of Representatives has passed the Mental Health in Aviation Act of 2025. What happens next? Well, that's how does the U.S. Congress work when it comes to changing laws? And the expert in that is John. You have done this at a very, very high level for a number of years. You've seen a lot of bills course their way through.
Yes. Right now, fortunately, this bill passed this year early. So we have more than a year for the Senate to take this bill up. Sometimes when the House passes legislation late in the term, which I'm talking with maybe May of next year, there's not enough time to move it through the Senate and get it passed into law, and then you have to start all over again. So the fortunate thing with this, what's going on this year, is that it passed early enough,
It's now over in the Senate, and it's working its way through the morass over there, and all the steps it has to go through to finally come up for discussion. So it'll be in committee, and the committee is going to have to work on it. And then if it comes out of committee, then it'll go to the full Senate, and they'll have to do some tweaking to it or discussion about it. So I'm happy that it came out. I'm happy that even I had a little bit to do with it with the rehearsal. The HBO program, a six-part series that I was involved with, which actually helped move it as well in a crazy way, in a way that is very much different not than normal, but it actually generated a lot of discussion on the Hill, and every little bit helps to move legislation forward. So I'm happy that Nathan Fielder and HBO were able to help move that bill along. So the work's not over. We need to now start all over again on the Senate. It was promoting the bill to all our senators from our states and just talk it up. So, and there's a lot of people involved, AOPA, the National Business Aircraft Association. There's a whole laundry list of people in the industry that have been speaking up, and some of them are finally speaking up in favor of dealing with this issue. Because we've had, for whatever reason, we've had a lot of visibility on pilot mental health issues, probably since the Wings accident where that pilot committed suicide and took an airplane full of people with them. Because there's been a number of events that have occurred after that to keep that issue on the front page. So it will get addressed, so hopefully.
And a very quick comment here from Chuckles K. You are all very welcome, and thank you. Thank you for that comment. And from a person who I did a shout-out for recently, from Ducky Michiel. Comment, definitely not French, smiley face. I work at SDF, which is the Louisville Airport. So, thank you for your comment. Thank you for being a special member. And, condolences to the whole community around Louisville, because as we all know from experiencing investigations in other places over the years, it's not just the people on the airplane, not just the people who were directly injured, but the entire community has been impacted by that. And again, I hope that over time that all of you who need help, reach out for it. All of you who see people who need help, see to it that they get the help that they need, even if that help is a pat on the back or just letting them talk it out. We also have a question also from, I believe, Chris Strobel 3439. Going back a little bit in time to 2018, many of you may remember there was a case where a ramp worker in Seattle took a Dash 8 for a flight. And to make a long story short, although there were concerns that there were threats to the metropolitan area of Seattle, the person who was flying it crashed the airplane, unfortunately lost his life. But the question arose from Chris Strobel 3439 regarding a 2018 Dash 8 incident in Seattle. How was a ramp worker able to steal an airplane in broad daylight? Well, I actually went out of my way and found a video on YouTube that was done by the Port of Seattle, which runs the Seattle airport, which showed very clearly the steps this person took. This was a person who, as a ramp worker, normally towed the aircraft around and had access, full access to the flight line. And without going into great detail, the way that airplanes are designed, you don't have to have a pair of airplane keys to start them. If you know what the procedure is and can go through the proper procedure to start up the airplane, you can do so. The video showed him starting the airplane, towing it to the middle of the ramp, unhooking the tow vehicle with the airplane still with the engines running. The airplane starts to creep slowly ahead. He runs back to the front entry door, opens the door, jumps in the airplane, and flies away. And from the by the way, this was not an accident. This was a deliberate event. So the kind of detailed analysis you would get from the NTSB did not happen here because this was not an NTSB event. But there were a lot of pieces of information that came out about this. Apparently, this person worked at Seattle for a number of years. There were no warning signs that he was going to do something like this. He was not part of a conspiracy. There was nothing out of the ordinary. before he took the airplane. And Ouellette, apparently, from what I understand, he had no formal flight training. How he got his knowledge from how to start the airplane and fly the airplane, it's up to speculation. There was speculation that he played a lot of video games. By the way, flight simulation video games can be very high fidelity for understanding how the systems work. Low fidelity for getting a feeling for how the airplane flies if you're in the cockpit. But if you want to understand what happens when a certain switch is hit, the flight simulator programs out there, which I use one, X-Plane, are very good for certain aspects of learning how to fly. Unfortunately, this person put it to a use that unfortunately ended his life. But again, this is a Greg and John question. You've been around a lot of airplanes. How hard is it to start an airplane if you know what you're doing?
If you have some basic knowledge, it's pretty easy. It's pretty easy. There's no key switch. If you know how to operate the door to get in and how to close it after you're in, it's a simple matter of going through a start procedure, which probably has anywhere from 4 to 10 steps in it, depending on the airplane. In fact, some of the more modern ones, it's even easier. Some of the latest. So it's pretty easy if you understand the process to start the airplane and taxi it. It's no different than driving your car, really. You might not be exactly on the center line of the runway, but it's pretty easy to do, to taxi an airplane. And if the airport's empty and you get to the runway, if it's close by, and it is in Seattle, you can get on the runway and be gone before the authorities can respond. So,
and a little background on that Seattle event. One of the authorities that are responding are F-15s out of the Portland Airport. They're aircraft on guard all around the country, ready to respond if there is an incursion, if there's a problem, what have you. So once this person took off, they're flying around Seattle. There were a lot of, if this were someone who was intent on injuring a lot of people, there were a lot of things happening in Seattle, including a big concert at the baseball stadium. And Portland, as a crow flies, is, about 100 nautical miles, 120 nautical miles away. Even if you're going full out, firewall the engines, let's say Mach 2, and you're taking off 5 minutes after there's a notification that something's going on, it might take another 5 minutes for that airplane to get up. So by the time the airplanes got to Seattle, if the person wanted to do something, they would have been too late, is the bottom line.
He narrated quite a bit, during the course of that flight. And there was a lot of talk, like you said, Todd, about, he did a lot of chair flying. It's pretty thorough as far as at least how to get the airplane airborne. Once he is airborne, he was just about screwing around and then got to a point where he did a maneuver that took the airplane into the ground. So
hopefully it gets tighter a little bit.
I don't want to belabor this point about mental health, but again, did anybody see any of the precursors for this guy wanting to do something like this? Had he talked about it in the past, this is a joke, I want to go, steal an airplane? I'm not a healthcare professional and a mental health professional, but, for that particular day, what triggered him to decide that was the day he was going to steal an airplane and go do what he was going to do and take himself out, versus were there other things ahead of that, was either a trigger where somebody saw a change in behavior, or he was talking about it as precursor to this ultimate event? We hear about that a lot when we have mass shootings and that kind of stuff, that there were precursors, but in isolation, they didn't mean anything. But when people look back at it, they go, oh yeah, this person did this, they said this, they acted like this. All of a sudden, you can put the pieces together. And I think that's the most difficult thing, not only for a pilot, but for anybody, but especially in aviation. You don't know what's going to trip their trigger to change their personality or react or do what they're going to do. either in a nefarious way or just, you know, take themselves out for whatever reason. So it's going to be a big issue going forward. It's going to be something that's very dynamic that will probably be in a constant state of change, because as we learn more and learn some or use some tools to help us determine the stability of a person, you know, things will change. And I hope that, you know, with aviation stays up with it, because we are safety critical position.
It's been swept under the rug for too long. It's got to come out. And and I don't know the answer to it. You know, as a society, I think we have this stigma that you don't want to be the telltale. You don't want to be the guy that calls somebody out. But when you think back of it, Greg, you and I, how many times have we heard after general business aviation accidents and general aviation accidents where other pilots will say, I'd never fly with him. I flew it once, I'll never do it again. You know, the accident that happened at Hanscom, the business jet that happened at Hanscom that killed a very wealthy person that owned the airplane, plus everybody on it. The very first thing I heard the next day when I was there, I was at Hanscom. The very next day in the pilot, in the FBO, I heard pilots saying, I used to be fly with him. I stopped years ago, or I stopped last year. I'll never fly with him because he was just an accident waiting to happen. Well, it would have been nice if we had a mechanism in place where we could have processed that and not have the stigma of being, you know, I'm going to tell tales out of school. We could have saved some lives.
Well, I think the NTSB has had precursor accidents like that. If you look at the King Air that crashed up in Elevent, Minnesota years ago, carrying I think it was a congressman who was on a campaign stump with his family. And, you know, the two pilots that were flying that come to find out through the investigation and through interview that they were two of the worst pilots in the company, and everybody knew it, yet nobody took any action, especially when they got paired together on an important flight like this. And so again, you know, the board just looked into it. This is what they said. They said it was, you know, pilot problems. They weren't coordinated. They allowed the airplane to get slow. The airplane stalled on final, killed everybody. That would have been a really good opportunity to get some mental health professionals in and really dissect why everybody thought these two pilots weren't up to snuff, why they got paired together, and, you know, the deficiencies between the two that that led to this this catastrophic accident. So,
a shout out to all the people who watched. I want to thank you for showing up today. And this live show will also be a regular episode in a couple of weeks' time. So if you didn't get a chance to see it, or if you have some friends of yours who want to see us live in action, uncut and unrehearsed, we'll be showing up again in the future. And for those of you who are watching right now, we'd like you to support us every way you can. If you're watching this on YouTube, like, subscribe, share, comment, all that's good. The comments, we had a few of them today. There's some excellent comments. It gives us ideas. And liking us, there's an algorithm out there that pounces us higher and higher, and perhaps we'll sort of supplant some of the people out there who are, let's just say they have a lot of traffic, but they don't have a whole lot to say. And subscribe. Thank you for being here. Thank you, John and Greg, for being here as well. And see us next month as well, live. And if you want to email us at flightsafetydetectives@gmail.com. We do read all of your emails, respond to a few of them, and we enjoy most of them. So thank you again.
I also would like to thank everybody and also thank our sponsor, you know, both PAMA and Avemco. You know, it's interesting with Avemco that both Greg and Todd are customers of Avemco. We don't get any special breaks. You know, we get the 5% that you could get just by listening to us. So both Greg and I have spent some time up in Maryland where Avemco has their offices and watching them in action. Not only just going into the facility and talking to them, but we actually hung around for a whole day with them and watched them handling sales, handling claims, and the rest of it. And I got to tell you, I was impressed. They were really good people. They are pilots themselves. They have a simulator in the office in the building that they fly. And it just really a wonderful customer service because of the understanding and the hands-on that they have with aviation. So that's not even part of the commercial. That's just my observation about Avemco and the way they handle themselves and handle their customers. And time is up for me, and I'll say goodbye to everybody. Thank you again. And please join up with us.